Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to Real GM Radio. I am Danny Lurie, your host, and so happy to have you with us for this episode. My guest is Fred Katz of The Athletic, the New York Knicks beat writer, and we had a lot to discuss from his excellent piece talking about the potential trade negotiations for Donovan Mitchell to Mitchell's conceptual fit with the Knicks, what the roster looks like now, the salary structure, the evolving NBA finances, Julius Randle's fit with this and potential future iterations of the team. Lots of really great stuff here. Conversation runs a little bit over an hour, and it is brought to you by Athletic Greens, really awesome new sponsor. You can go to athleticgreens.com/realgm to check them out. And our friends at betonline.ag, use that CLNS50 promo code for a 50% welcome bonus. I really love this pod. I hope you enjoy it as well. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I'll start this with an apology. You and I usually do Capriati's at some point during Summer League, but I think because of our different schedules this year, that didn't end up happening. So I apologize for that. It is something I truly look forward to every year.
I know. Well, you know what? Capriati's, like when we started going there, it was just a Vegas thing. And now they're all over. There's one in New York. There's one in D.C. They're in like a million different cities. So I don't feel like it's so D.C. or so Vegas specific anymore. You know, like there's one on like 70 something street in New York right now, 80 something street. I can just like run up there and get a Capriati sandwich and I'm good to go.
I'm thrilled for them. By the way, congratulations on your success, Capriati's. Fred and I can speak your praises as much as we want to, but you
those
are not
turkey sandwiches. Those turkey sandwiches are absolutely bonkers good.
Instead, let's get to a different kind of investment, and that is the Knicks potentially investing via trade and then potentially, you know, eventually signing in Donovan Mitchell. You wrote a really good piece for The Athletic that came out on Tuesday talking about some of these, the nuances of these trade negotiations. And what makes this a fascinating set piece for me is that we know the Knicks are interested in Donovan Mitchell. This is not exactly a secret anywhere, but we also know how Danny Ainge negotiates. And I like the way that you phrased it, that they're natural trade partners, but that doesn't mean that a trade is going to happen immediately, if necessarily ever.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're perfect trade partners, but imperfect negotiation partners.
Right.
It's, you know, a lot about one of the things that I think is the most interesting about the NBA and kind of why I wrote that story is that so much of what happens has just kind of nothing to do with what makes sense with the basketball. It's just because people are people and there's always personal dynamics. Sometimes the reason that the guy took the bad shot at the end of the game is just because that's part of it. It's not because he doesn't know it's a bad shot. It's just because it's part of his personality to be able to say, I'm a big time player and I can take this shot. And like, there's just so much of what happens in this league, and I'm sure in any other professional league, is just there's a humanity behind it. And I think there's a humanity to these trade negotiations in that, you know, the Knicks often, not always, and I say this in that story, but they often have Brock Aller, who's, for lack of a better term, their cap guy, do like the day-to-day stuff on trades. And then Leon Rose, who's the team president, will come in and wrap everything up. And obviously he's got final say and everything like that, which is, they're hardly the only team that does anything like that. I mean, like, you can look at great organizations. A lot of them run like that. Like, Toronto runs like that. Masai Ujiri is not trading for, you know, G League guys. You know, Bobby Webster, who's their GM, is kind of doing more of the day-to-day trade conversations when they have them, you know? So it's not totally irregular or anything like that. But with the way that Brock Aller tends to negotiate, he's kind of a stickler, you know. I have heard stories from other teams on deals that haven't even gotten done, deals that have gotten done, of just like him being like, no, we need those extra draft rights. Like, we got to have the draft rights to that extra guy.
Yes.
We just have to. We got to have those draft rights. And they're like, this guy is 42 years old. He was drafted in 1999. He hasn't played professional basketball in 13 years. And he doesn't even meet, like, for example, they got draft rights to two guys in that Alec Burks, Nerlens Noel salary dump. And this is not an example, by the way, which I heard this went down in the negotiation. But they got draft rights to two guys. They just changed the minimum consideration rules for draft rights in the league like a few weeks ago. It used to be up to the league's consideration. I like that I'm on your podcast, so I can just talk about minimum consideration and assume that the listeners know what it is.
Or at bare minimum that they care and might look it up further if they don't.
Exactly. But minimum consideration is just the least you're actually allowed to give up in a trade. You can't top 59 protect a pick, draft pick, for example. It's got to be top 55. That's the most protected you can be. That's minimum consideration, because league rule says you can't just acquire someone in a trade. You have to send something out. And often, if it's just like you want to kind of, in principle, just acquire someone without sending something out, you send back a top 55 protected draft pick, or you send out a draft rights guy. And it used to be that it was up to the league's discretion whether the draft rights to a player could be counted as minimum consideration. You couldn't just use the draft rights to someone. Like, the Hawks have the draft rights to someone who was drafted in like 1982. I think it's the oldest draft rights in the league. Like, they couldn't use that as minimum consideration. But they made it so, like, in a two-team trade, you have to be from the last five drafts to meet minimum consideration, and in a three-team trade, it has to be from the last nine. And one of the guys they got from Detroit with the draft rights, like, doesn't even meet minimum consideration in a two-team trade. They traded for the draft rights of Brad Newley earlier this season.
Oh, Brad Newley, yeah,
sure. And he was drafted in like 2006. It's like they obsess, and that was a little bit of a personal connection, because Brad Newley was one of Leon Rose's clients as well. So I think they got a little romantic. I think they got a little romantic with that trade. But like, they are real sticklers for details, for marginal value in trades, not wanting to give up extra second rounders, wanting to acquire extra second rounders, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that sort of personality is in direct contrast to the way that Danny Ainge likes to negotiate. And by the way, I think Zanuck in Utah does a lot of their day-to-day stuff too. And Ainge sets the principle of, here is what I deem this player worth in a trade, and when you're willing to give that up, give me a call. And until then, I'll be chilling. And I just think the personal dynamics here, even though, like, Donovan Mitchell to the Knicks makes perfect sense, and the Knicks B package to Utah, even just like not even their best package to Utah, makes sense as a return for Donovan Mitchell. Just those personalities, just, I'm not saying it's not going to get done. I think there's a very realistic chance it gets done. It just affects the process as you go through it.
It does. And the other important context that I think is essential for understanding how these negotiations are going to go is the idea that the Knicks will view the Mitchell negotiations, ideally, in a broader context, which is the resources that they do not send out in a Mitchell trade could potentially be involved in getting somebody else to New York. And so the less they give up, and this was my big criticism of Minnesota with the Rudy Gobert trade, is that they gave up so much over so many years that it made it hard for them to significantly improve. And if the Knicks did something commensurate with that, then if they want to add another good player to this core, they could do that. You know, the Knicks, depending on what salary goes out and goes in, like, it's probably not going to be with cap space, but they have enough filler salary to make things work. There are a lot of different ways that could get structured. If they give up too much in this, it's going to be very hard. And then you're saying, unless you can get a haul, like, they, and the Knicks have done some very good arbitrage during the Rose years, but it's been more on the kind of more on the margins than on the, like, the large stuff. And so if you give up the whole thing for Donovan Mitchell, then you're not even going to be able to get like somebody who could be potentially like the third best player on the next great Knicks team. Like that's more what you're looking for. And if they're going to be honest with themselves, and I mean, it would be a criticism of mine if they don't, is getting Donovan Mitchell unambiguously makes the Knicks better, depending on the structure, but in the immediate, how it's going to go. But it doesn't make them like a championship contender. And you can respond to that two ways. You can respond to that by saying, we're happy with where we are, even if that's not what happens, maybe we'll exceed it. Or you could say, well, we're going to have to do something else. And both of those are reasonable paths. Which one they evaluate and then would subsequently choose should a Mitchell trade happen is important. But the context of this is a move, not the last move or the only move, is extremely important.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. If I'm running the Knicks, and this is just my personal opinion, I can't tell you this is exactly how the Knicks are thinking. But if I were running the Knicks, the way that I would be approaching this is my max package, and I wouldn't necessarily offer this logic to Utah, but my max package that I would offer for Donovan Mitchell would have enough to left over to where I felt like I could still bring in somebody big, specifically in the summer of 2024. I think that's kind of where, if you look at the way their cap sheet is right now, I think that's kind of where they're in a position to make the next trade 2 years down the line. You know, they're going to have Brunson on the final guaranteed year of his deal in 24-25. Julius Randle on the final year of his deal in 24-25. They're going to have Mitchell Robinson still under contract, and he's on a descending deal. I think he's making about a little over $14 million that year.
Correct.
I say he's like $14.3 that year. I don't have it directly.
I do. It is $14.3. It's disturbing how right you got that. Though it was like a week ago, but still, I'm impressed.
I look at these numbers way too much, Danny. It's like it's a problem. I have a serious problem. But you know, they're going to be really expensive. The starting five in 24-25, just their starting five is going to take them really, really close to the tax or to the cap, and that roster is going to be seriously in danger of going into the tax. And that's okay to go into the tax, but you want to be really good if you're going into the tax. And I think you're in a position just kind of with those contracts. You know, if Brunson outplays his contract, they might be able to treat that as an expiring deal, because there might be the assumption, whoever's trading for him, that he's not going to pick up the player option. And if he outplays his contract, somebody might just be really happy to take him because he's a good player. Or I guess if he outplays the contract, he's a very good player on a very reasonable contract. So I think there's something that they can do. Also, 2 years down the line, it would open up another draft pick. Now you can trade your 2031 first round pick as well. So if they're able to hold on to, because they have four draft picks from other teams, they have Milwaukee 2025, they have Washington 2023, which is protected to 2026, they have Detroit 2023, which is protected to 2027, and they have Dallas's 2023, which is almost certainly going to convey because it'll probably be in the 20s and it's only top 10 protected. It's almost certainly going to convey next year. If they're able to like deal those picks and maybe their 2023 and 2025, even if the 2023 and 2025 are unprotected, then all of a sudden come the summer of 2024, they can put together those contracts. They can maybe put together a good player or two, and they're able to trade now their 2027, 29, and 31 first round picks. And maybe they're able to acquire some other teams' first round picks. And now you got like, that's a legitimate offer to bring in another star. And in 2024, Donovan Mitchell's only going to be 27 and RJ Barrett's only going to be 23. It's not like, or 24. It's not like that is, you know, so far down the line that now these guys are out of their primes. You know, if everything goes well, RJ Barrett's not even in his prime yet. And you know, Mitchell is at the very beginning part of it. So I think that would be a very reasonable way for them to look at things.
I really like that framing. And I think that the kind of thinking about the age of the Knicks around that 24 season is very useful, because like teams don't have to think in terms of like everybody peaking at the same time, but that does give you often the best chance that you have of being competitive. And so working through some of that, so let's use that 24 season as a lens. That would be RJ Barrett's age 24 season, Julius Randle's age 30 season, Mitchell Robinson 26, Jalen Brunson 28. So like a lot of these guys, they're, I wouldn't say they're post prime, but they're probably in their prime or in the vicinity RJ a little bit younger, and then whichever, you know, young guys you still have, which is an open question. And it puts them in a place where, yeah, I mean, that's going to be shot. And then the other possibility, which I'm sure Brock Aller is getting into, is there is a distinct possibility that in that window around that time, the cap could go up significantly. And if that's the case, then either A, that reduces, mitigates your luxury tax bill, or that gives you additional flexibility that you could use in a different way. Like maybe you find a home for one or two of those players we were discussing, and then you could use cap space. And then if you could get a, you know, and that might be in 25, like that might be the way to do it, is all of a sudden it's like, instead of using that flexibility in 24, you could actually clear a max slot in 25 to pair along with Mitchell and everything else. Like that's, but we'll know a lot by that point about where those things are. And we do not know those things at this moment. And so you set yourself up to have the right pieces to make the right decision.
Totally.
Danny,
just adding on to that, I wonder what's going to happen with that 2025 when all that money comes in 2025 from the new TV deal. Because like, so Danny, you live in the Bay Area. That was a thing in 2016 where cap spike goes up and the Warriors are able to get Kevin Durant even after a 73 win season and with relatively expensive players. And I think a lot of people in the league were so turned off by a team's ability to do that, because I want to say it spiked from like 67 million to 90 or 92 in 2016. I wouldn't be shocked if there was some amount of cap smoothing there, because that was just, that pissed off like 29 teams when that happened.
I think there will be either smoothing or some sort of other non-linear kind of solution to it, where maybe it's like you distribute that money among players. You don't put it all into the salary cap. Like that isn't even necessarily smoothing. It could be something else, like you just structure things a little bit differently for a couple of years and balance it. But yeah, I think there will be enough there. And then the other part of that, because, you know, this is collectively bargained, it's a collective bargaining agreement, is I don't think the players were thrilled about overall that some players got an immense benefit and others did not. You know, the idea, and yes, it was known a couple years ahead, and certain players, just as was the case with LeBron and Wade and all that, like those guys timed their free agency for a reason. Guys timed their free agency with 16 because their agents did a good job and told them it was there. I think it led to some weird differentiations. I mean, you could bring up like Timofey Mozgov as like a player who benefited, or Evan Turner, or some of these guys who benefited from circumstance, and then other players most certainly did not, because they were maybe free agents in 14 or 15 and they didn't time it out. And so, yeah, I think that there will be something. I don't know exactly what that something will be, but it's also possible that, I mean, and there's some of this reporting that the new national TV deal could be 2 to 2.5 to 3 times higher than the current one, that you could only smooth so much, that it'll be an increase. It just won't be a Durant-esque increase. And so it's a consideration. But again, and like I wrote a piece years ago, people could read it. I believe that one was at the Sporting News about the Oklahoma City Thunder. And like, I had this criticism that like basically part of my interpretation of the motivation for trading James Harden was that they didn't think they could afford their team, but they didn't wait long enough. And it ended up being that because revenues went up higher, they could have. And that's why time matters here.
Yeah. I mean, I think that all makes perfect sense. I'm super fascinated by what's going to happen there. I know that like there are so many people who just they watch basketball for the basketball, and that makes perfect sense. That's why I started watching basketball too. But there are certain things that happen on the financial side that just impact everything to such an immense degree, and who goes where. It's going to be very interesting to see how the league handles that.
Let's get to the question that I actually think should be at the forefront in some ways of this. I mean, the negotiations, and you wrote about it so well, it's so interesting. You and I both love that. How do you think of Donovan Mitchell's fit with the Knicks as presently constituted, and as that constitution could change over the next 3 to 4 years?
So I think the first thing that people are tending to say when they think of Donovan Mitchell's fit is they wonder about the defensive match with Jalen Brunson, where Brunson's not a bad defender by any means. He fights hard. He's super stout. He's really strong. He's hard to back down. He plays like good fundamental defense, but he's small, and you can only make up for that so much. And Mitchell, has been one of the holes on the Jazz's perimeter for like years now. We've been talking about the Jazz's perimeter defense just not being able to stick in front of guys. And when you go through the list, it's like, well, okay, Rudy Gobert is not the defensive problem there. Royce O'Neal's not the defensive problem there. Bogdanovich is like guarded LeBron in the playoffs. When he was with Indiana, they would use him to like guard LeBron. I think you can make a pretty good, and Mike Conley is absolutely not what he used to be, but he's also kind of similar to how I defended Brunson. He's not the same type of defender because he's more slender and quick, but he's a fundamental defender. It's not like he's gambling, getting caught out of position. I mean, I think Mitchell was the biggest problem for them on the perimeter, even though he's long and he's athletic. And if he used his length and his athleticism for good, it could be a total game changer. But we just haven't actually seen that play out in the court. And I get it, and I agree with those criticisms, and maybe I'm just in my own echo chamber, and that's just what I'm seeing, and it's not what people are talking about the most. It just happens to be what I'm seeing the most. That being said, I actually think Mitchell and Brunson are a pretty fantastic offensive fit together. Like, I could see that really excelling. You know, Brunson has a whole ton of experience playing alongside an offensive hub. And, you know, playing next to Luka, obviously, for a number of years. And he played really well off of Luka. He was excellent on those weak side catch and goes. He's so clever inside the 3-point line. He's just got so many moves. Like, he was a power forward when he was in high school. And he plays like a power forward who happens to be a small point guard. And I love watching those guys who have totally different cadences. That's why I'm like obsessed with watching like Kyle Anderson or Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Just like, Brunson has that sort of weird offbeat way that he plays, and it really works next to really worked next to Luka. And with Mitchell, I think it could work as well, even though those guys are stylistically different. With Mitchell, I think Mitchell has shown that he can absolutely thrive, and when he's thriving, the team thrives, which is not always the truth for a guy getting his own individual offense. Like, the Jazz have led the league in points per possession. They have broken the single season record in points per possession with Donovan Mitchell being their offensive leader. So there's no question he is fully capable of being the head of an excellent offense, but I don't think he's the same as Luka in that he's not that level of passer. He's not that level of facilitator. And when you load up on him, it's nice to have an actual competent point guard next to him who can run a pick and roll, who can create something, you know, on the weak side or do something with 13 seconds left on the shot clock. Mitchell has to give it up. And I think Brunson absolutely is that level of player who's good enough to do that. So I think those guys are a pretty great match. Mitchell's just a 3-level scorer who can score from anywhere. I think that guy just tends to be able to, I don't think he's a selfish player either. Like, I think that guy tends to fit with a Brunson, tends to fit with a Barrett. He takes 10 threes a game. The Knicks need somebody who takes threes because Lord knows that offense needs some shooting. I think offensively, he's like kind of a great fit with what they already have.
Broadly speaking, I agree with you. I think that the Brunson-Mitchell offensive fit is not really a concern for me. And I think one stat on that gets lost a little bit, I'm happy you brought up how great the Jazz offense has been the last couple of years. And there are a lot of different reasons why the Jazz offense succeeded. First of all, they played just a lot of guys who could shoot, which is an immense benefit. And we'll get into that with the Knicks context. But like, this is the stat that I wanted to mention. When Donovan Mitchell played without Mike Conley last year, so that means the secondary creator was often Jordan Clarkson. Like, that's just, you know, who the Jazz had in that situation. Utah last year, 120.9 cleaning the glass offensive rating. That is phenomenal. That is the top 5 percentile in the NBA last year. And it wasn't quite as rosy in 2020/21, but it was still top 10 percentile in the league when Donovan Mitchell played without Mike Conley. And Conley, you know, like, it's not like he has had the greatest last 2 years. I still think he's a really good player. I think teams have to respect it. So the idea that it can work, and part of why I like Donovan Mitchell as a fit with this group, and by the focus on that, I'm going to say is Brunson and Barrett, is that having another guy who can create an advantage, I think, will yield benefits. And one way of thinking about that is RJ didn't take a ton of pull-up threes, but he shot 25% on them last year, and he shot 37% on catch and shoot. And those shots are easier for almost every player in the league. And so that's not to say RJ Barrett's just going to stand in the corner and do nothing. He's not going to be on the Dorian Finney-Smith diet whenever Brunson and Mitchell are on the floor. But generally speaking, there is this frontier that the more the more you use within an offense, the less efficient a player is going to be. And so there'll be a lot of times that Barrett, he's more of a dangerous, to me, secondary creator than primary. And that's true of almost everybody, but it's true for him. So I agree with you. I think that the triumvirate there offensively, I think that'll work. And then the other important element of this, and this has come up, you could bring up a lot of different situations for this over the last couple of years in the NBA, is that as a practical consideration, depending on how Tibbs runs the rotation or theoretically a future coach, having two of those three on the floor with maybe a lower usage kind of wing guy, that could work out really well too, because then you have somebody who can create an advantage, you have somebody who can convert it, and then you have a secondary creator if they overload. And that can work really well to make it happen. Plenty more with Fred Katz, but first a message from a new sponsor for Real Jam Radio, Athletic Greens. It is a product that I use every day. I started taking AG1 because I was looking for a consistent, healthy morning routine, and AG1 fit it perfectly when I got it. It's something that you take right when you wake up in the morning, and it gives you a nice boost throughout the day. Also, I think it's done a good job of making me have healthier patterns throughout the day, and I absolutely love it. I've been doing it for now for a couple weeks, and it's hard to kind of imagine not doing so. And also, I really like that it has less than 1 gram of sugar, no GMOs, nasty chemicals, and still tastes good. And one way of thinking about it is that AG1, it's a small micro habit with big benefits. It's something you can do every single day. It doesn't take a lot of work, but it'll make a difference in terms of taking great care of yourself, which is so important. And they have over 7,000 five-star reviews, so you can check it out. And the way to check it out, to make it easy, is you go... So Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. So you go to athleticgreens.com/realgm, R-E-A-L-G-M, to check it out. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/realgm to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. My big concern stems from the power forward spot, because if you want, you brought up, and astutely so, Jalen Brunson and what worked really well for him with the Mavericks, and that was maximal floor spacing, guys who kind of knew what they were doing, who were putting stress on the opposing defense in different ways. Jalen Brunson is an unbelievable finisher, and he finishes better in traffic than most people his size basically ever have, but it's a lot easier to do that when there's one guy or maybe zero guys as opposed to two or three. And so I think that Julius Randle, his fit with that structure is actually distinctly bad unless teams respect his three and unless Julius Randle is okay with his role within that offense.
Yeah, I honestly think the latter part is going to be even more important than the shooting. And the shooting last year was really problematic. Like, you look at all of Randle's shooting and it's like, amongst guys with usage rates over 20%, and 20% is just league average, which is why I set the marker there. Amongst guys with usage rate over 20%, Randle was like bottom two or bottom three in effective field goal percentage. Amongst guys who took, you know, high volume guys from the mid range, I think like the top 34 in attempts per game, I think Randle was 34th in percentage from mid range. The shooting was not even close to there, and his percentages around the rim were not where you want them to be. Now part of that was the way the Knicks played. They did not play with a lot of shooters. They almost always use a conventional center who hangs around the rim. Last year, it was Mitchell Robinson, who I remain convinced, my hot take that nobody would ever call hot because it is so nerdy, is that if there were a advanced tracking stat that tracked how often guys have at least what percentage of the time on offense that guys have at least 1 foot in the paint, Mitchell Robinson would lead the league, because Mitchell Robinson he'll run a dribble handoff every once in a while, but he's still like a flawed dribble handoff guy. He's a flawed screener. He doesn't put the ball on the floor. He's not going to venture out far from the rim ever. And the Knicks weaponize him as an offensive rebounder. So he just hangs there and it clogs stuff up. And if you look at Julius Randle's shot selection last year, he took significantly more shots at the rim when Julius Randle, Taj Gibson, Jericho Sims, when Mitchell Robinson, Taj Gibson, Jericho Sims, or Nerlens Noel was not there with him, and he was next to Obi Toppin, or he was there at the five by himself. He went up significantly. His shot selection totally changed. I spoke to him about it midseason, and he told me it was completely conscious. He was like, my role changes when there's just a five in there clogging the paint. I got to become more of a jump shooter. Look, I don't think the Knicks have constructed themselves to where they're implying they want to play differently this year. They gave 4 years and $60 million to Mitchell Robinson. He is going to play. They signed, you know, Isaiah Hartenstein, who I think was a good value signing. He started taking some threes at the end of last year, but and he's not the same type of player at all as Mitchell Robinson, but it's not like he's some sort of spot up stretch five who's going to hang around the 3-point line. If you use him like that, you're actually misusing him. You kind of want him in the high post and you want him facilitating and you want to weaponize his passing, you know? And with Randall, it's like, if you put him in proper situations, I think the shooting might be able to get a little bit better. He might be able to get a little more comfortable. It fell off to such a degree last year. But I think the greatest question is the second part of what you said, which is he going to accept that Jalen Brunson's going to have to create? And if Donovan Mitchell happens to be there, which is obviously possible, how is he going to react to that? Because last year, so much of their offense, especially in the important moments, was Julius Randle brush screen, and then he just kind of drifts over to the high post on the left side of the court, and then the ball handler just lobs it into him with 14 seconds left on the clock, and he jabs and he fakes and he jabs again, and then he goes one dribble, maybe he goes a second dribble, but it kind of ends in a contested step back. And that was just their offense. You know, if you want to run a different type of offense, and Julius Randle is so married to those habits that he just has to play that way, he's going to be extremely disruptive to your ecosystem. And so how Julius Randle handles having to play a different way, are you going to get him to play like he did in New Orleans? Is that going to be tough with Mitchell Robinson out there, because he's just going to be double and triple teamed every single time, because you can help off of RJ Barrett when he's out there as well. It's just, you can also help off of Jalen Brunson, because Brunson can absolutely shoot, but at least historically, until he starts taking like 5 threes a game, you can operate under the assumption that he doesn't like to catch and shoot. He likes to catch and go.
We saw it in the Western Conference Finals.
Totally. Absolutely. So you can help off of him, even though he's a legitimately good 3-point shooter. Spacing is about habits and geography even more than it's about actual shooting ability. And, you know, that's going to be a huge question for them after the way Randle performed last year.
It's a great point. I don't know, Fred, if you've ever looked into this. If you haven't, this might end up becoming a piece. But I saw this and then I told Nate about it, and it became something we talked about a couple times on the pod last year. I'm going to rattle through Clean the Glass. You can do a usage filter, but it'll do it by percentile based on positional group, because they're, you know, wing, like point guards use the ball more and everything else like that. But I'm going to go through, I'll try to do it in order. It's not in order, but I'll try to do it in order of players' usage percentage. So basically, the easy shorthand there is that it's like, basically, how many times did that player take a shot, including a free throw, turn the ball over, or assist on a basket? So of players who played at least 200 minutes in the NBA last year, here are the ones who had a usage percentage. 10.2 is going to be that's going to be the highest number that I use for this. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Jericho Sims, 6.6%. Nerlens Noel, 7.3%. Remember, this is the entire NBA, all players who played over 200 minutes. Noel, 7.3%. Tony Snell, 8.7%. Matisse Thybulle, 9.1%. Taj Gibson, 9.5%. Wes Matthews, 10. Royce O'Neal, 10.1. Mitchell Robinson, 10.2. Mo Harkless, 10.2. There's a commonality between about half of the players in that eight player group. And so you think about, like, it's a really interesting thing, because you could say, yeah, a lot of those guys are limited. A lot of it, you know, this is coaching. You know, it's that you're choosing to do that. But there's a big problem. Like, there's a difference between having super low usage Tony Snell and, oh, I forgot, John Conchars. He's at 9.5 as well. Apologies to John Conchars. Congratulations on the extension. But there's a difference between a wing or even a point guard who doesn't have the ball in their hands a lot. I mean, if they're a non-shooter, if we get into some of those things. But if you're a non-spacing big who also just never has the ball in their hands, think about how that affects the way your offense flows.
It's very true. And I don't need to think about it. I saw it. It affects the way your offense flows. There's no question. What I will say, to put those in a little bit further context, you're right. All those guys are clearly limited offensively to varying degrees. But I think part of the reason that we saw that to such an extreme, saw that trend to such an extreme, was that the Knicks just had absolutely no point guard play last year. Derrick Rose played 26 games and then got hurt And they started the whole year, basically. They started either Kemba Walker, who just had a few good games but seriously struggled and wasn't able to blow by anybody or really get to the paint at all. When he was good, it was for the most part just because he was hitting his jump shots. And you have to be able to, like, you know, a player like that, a player like Mitchell Robinson, if you're going to get his usage up to like 14, he's never going to be a 20% usage guy, but if you're going to get his usage up to like 14%, right? 15%, which is kind of acceptable. That's probably where like a Daniel Gafford is, right? 14, 15, 16, 17%. If you're going to get him there, you're often going to get him there because he's coming up high. He's setting screens. A ball handler is going around that screen. The big is screening the ball handler's man. He's getting downhill and he's throwing him a lob or getting him a dump off or whatever else, right? Like, that's going to make up for a consequential amount of that guy's, you know, shots. And that just wasn't something they had. Kemba Walker wasn't able to get downhill to make those things happen. And then they played a significant chunk of the year once Walker was gone with Alec Burks at the point. And Alec Burks is just not a point guard. And on top of all of that, they were the slowest team in the league getting into their offense. They just would walk the ball up the floor, and so many times they just wouldn't even run an action until there was like 13 on the shot clock, which is just honestly an unacceptable way to run your offense. Like, you're just shooting yourself in the foot when you do that. Somebody makes a basket and they're just giving you the opportunity to walk up the floor and get into your offense. There is never a reason why you should be getting into your offense and running the first action with 13 left on the shot clock, save for the, you know, the last possession of a quarter or something like that. There's never a reason you should be doing that in the middle of a game. And the Knicks did it all the time. And it was because they just didn't have anything close to average point guard play. And I think if they did, those numbers would look a little different. And those guys would be a little more consequential. And they will have competent point guard play this year, because no matter what you think of the Jalen Brunson contract, he's a good player. Like, he is a good point guard, and he is a good winning basketball player. So they'll have that this year. So I wonder how those numbers will change for Mitchell Robinson this season, because I think they're going to be able to get him the ball in better spots.
For sure. And we'll see what if that was the circumstance. And I'm really happy you brought up their point guard limitations, because that is such an important element that changes the way a team plays. It's just, is there somebody who could get your players in those spots to succeed, who could get the ball to your bigs? But it also is, you know, like, who are you running these actions with? Are you running it with Mitchell Robinson? Are you running it with Randall? Like, all that. There are considerations there. And to try to put a number on the point that you were just making, it's a very useful thing and unpredictable. They've separated out, Seth Partnow actually talks about this well in his book as well, of that pace. We've conflated over the years, we've conflated pace when it is actually offensive pace and defensive pace. And so the idea is, so what unpredictable does is it separates it out. And so it's like, okay, how much time do you take to shoot? And so after a made shot last year, the Knicks were the third slowest team to taking something. They were fourth slowest overall. And part of the reason they were fourth slowest is because they got a fair amount of offensive rebounds, and you shoot it really fast off of an offensive rebound, including Mitchell Robinson and everybody else. But they were, after a made shot, they were third slowest. After a defensive rebound, they were fourth slowest to get a shot up. And then they were 20th after a defensive rebound. And then they were faster after an offensive rebound, which, you know, we're talking about margins here within like a tenth of a second for those. So that ties in with exactly what you were saying. It was taking them too long to get in their actions. And that's to get a shot. But the point that you were making, which is so important, is that it's not only about when you take the shot, it's also about when you start the action that can lead to it, because that gives the defense more time, or in this case, less time, to break down to create a better shot.
Totally. Can I add to this with an absolutely bonkers stat, which I wrote probably two-thirds of the way into the season, but it's still relevant, even though it's, you know, probably 25 games out of date, because the numbers didn't change?
Of course.
So I wrote this in a story that I was very excited about, but was so nerdy that I don't think anybody else was quite as excited. But all right. So I had somebody with the team. I don't get to have a Second Spectrum account, but I had somebody with the team look this up for me, because Second Spectrum tracks it. So I'll read this. The Knicks average 19.4 seconds on possessions when Alec Burks brings the ball up. 88 players had brought the ball up at least 500 times through that point in the season. Alec Burks ranked 88th in terms of average seconds per possession when he brings the ball up. 19.4 seconds.
Amazing.
That means that they are on an average possession. They are getting off a shot with less than 5 seconds left on the shot clock. I'm not done. So Alec Burks was 88th out of 88. Do you know who 87th out of 88 was?
Oh, no.
Kemba Walker.
Woo!
So that's really your problem.
Well, so how much of that do you think, though, is how much of that is Alec Burks and Kemba Walker, both of whom we'll see on different teams this year? And how much of that do you think is Tom Thibodeau?
I would say it's kind of all intertwined, because like the reason Alec Burks is running the point as opposed to like Emmanuel Quickley is because of Tibbs. So it's kind of intertwined. Look, Tibbs for the most part is not necessarily playing with like fast offenses or anything like that. But I would say the majority of it was Burks and Walker. I mean, I don't think, and that's just based on like the eye test. You know, there were just so many possessions. Like I'm not a Knicks fan, but I like watching basketball, you know, played in its most beautiful form. And there are just so many possessions where Alec Burks was just slowly walking it up and he crossed half court at 16. And then he just kind of dribbled, you know, 37 feet away from the rim, just kind of dribbled there. And nobody came up and set a screen. And then somebody comes up and sets the screen. And now, whoop, there's 12 seconds left in the clock. You let half the shot clock just kind of trickle away. And I think it was more on the players. That said, to be clear, with Burks specifically, it was on Burks, but like it wasn't Burks's fault, because Alec Burks isn't a point guard. And that's why I say it's kind of all kind of just tied together. Like Alec Burks is not a point guard. That's not how you best utilize Alec Burks. Alec Burks is a really quality rotation wing. If Alec Burks is coming off the bench as a wing for you, he can defend competently. He's turned himself into a 40% three-point shooter. Like he's a solid passer as a wing. He's a good ball mover within your offense. Like that's a winning player, Alec Burks, as coach speak would like to say. But like that's just not how Alec Burks should be used. He's a good quality rotation wing, and that's not how the Knicks used him last year. So like, yes, it's on Burks, but it's not really on Burks, you know?
Agreed. It's a mix of the two, and they are so intertwined. But that's why, you know, multiple years of context will eventually get us closer to that. The Knicks were, after a made shot in 2020/21, so the year before, they were the slowest team off of made shots and off of defensive rebounds as well. So like, this is not a, I think their personnel was pretty similar between those 2 years, but
that was also like they had massive point guard issues that year. That was Elfrid Payton.
That was the Elfrid Payton year. And that was, yeah. And that was the year that they got Derrick Rose halfway through, if memory serves. Like they didn't have him for the first part of the year. They were better, I believe, in the years before that. So that's all really interesting. Plenty more with Fred Katz, but first a message from betonline.ag. Our partners at BetOnline continue to be the number one source for all your betting needs and sports information. Find all the latest odds, news, and sports developments, including Major League Baseball scores, all the latest fighting news, and even next season's early NFL features. BetOnline is your continued source for all your sports wagering information, from live betting to playoffs, esports, and more. So head to the website, use the promo code CLNS50. It gives you a 50% welcome bonus. Also tells them you came from us. So head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today. Again, use that CLNS50 promo code to get the bonus and get into the action at BetOnline, where the game starts. The other kind of Knicks roster thing I want to discuss, it's so funny because when he was on the Rockets and then to a lesser extent on Denver, I was not a huge believer in Isaiah Hartenstein. I thought he had an awesome year with the Clippers, and I wondered what his free agency was going to look like. There was this, you know, the idea, and I thought he looked, you know, his rim protection numbers were good. He actually was an underrated distributor last year. Like the Clippers had kind of a different theory of their second unit when Hartenstein was out there. He was more of a hub than they ever asked Zubats to be, and worked out pretty well. And so I was like, okay, who's going to give him that contract? Where's it going to work? And there was also like Nate and I had these discussions about whether Hartenstein was better than Mitchell Robinson. All of a sudden they end up on the same team, and it's a team that uses traditional centers an overwhelming proportion of the time. So it'll be a challenge to navigate this, but I'm excited to see how this ends up working out.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I think there's a world where their center rotation plays out, and there's a sect of the fan base that wants Hartenstein starting over Mitchell Robinson.
I would start him now. I don't think the Knicks will.
I mean, one of them got 2 years, $16 million, and one of them got 4 years, $60 million. So I think we can guess which one is going to start.
Yeah, I mean, Mitchell Robinson is making, because his contract is front-loaded, Mitchell Robinson is making more in 22-23 than Hartenstein is over his entire contract.
Exactly. The other part of it is whether you think one or the other is better in a vacuum. I think Hartenstein is just the better fit with the starters because of all the issues that we talked about. So I think that's going to be a really interesting dynamic to see how that plays out. Maybe it won't matter who's starting and who's backing up. Maybe we read more into who's closing. Because for all, Tibbs is weird with his rotations because in some ways he can be really stubborn with his rotations, like how he just kind of wouldn't really play quickly at the point until the end of last year or starting Burks at the point a bunch, or which, by the way, the lineup data starting Burks at the point was not as much of an eyesore as you might think. Like, the lineup data was okay, and the reason that they were doing it was because Burks just gave him size and the ability to switch a little bit more on defense. But, you know, the way that he just really has not given Julius Randle, Obi Toppin, you know, those two guys playing together in the front court, he hasn't really given that much of a fair shot. He can be stubborn in that way. But within the context of a singular game, he's pretty loose on what he will do in terms of a closing lineup. Like, he'll sit his starters if another lineup is rolling, and he'll sit Julius Randle if a lineup is rolling. It happened multiple times last year where Julius Randle either sat for the fourth quarter or sat until much later than what his usual substitution rotation would be because a lineup was really rolling without him. Because a lot of lineups with Obi Toppin would get rolling because Toppin just kind of, good things just kind of happen when Obi Toppin's on the floor. And so it's going to be interesting maybe to see just like who's closing more. Like if Hartenstein is consistently outplaying, and by the way, you look at the advanced rim protection data, and he was the second best, like I think opponents shot 47.5% on layups and dunks when he was the closest defender. I believe that was the second best figure amongst qualifying big men in the NBA last year. Better than Mitchell Robinson, who had very good numbers in that, and that's part of the reason he got $15 million a year and average annual value. But like, it's going to be interesting to see who's closing, because if Hartenstein is consistently outplaying Mitchell Robinson, I think Tibbs will go with him, because Tibbs has a preference towards rim protection, but both those guys are rim protectors. They're very different types of rim protectors stylistically. Hartenstein is more of a positional rim protector, whereas Mitchell Robinson is I have really long arms and I'm really athletic, so you should be scared of me rim protector. But they're both effective, so I'm very intrigued to see how Tibbs is going to handle a bunch of those fourth quarters when you know the backup center is rolling.
There's also the balance of the short game and the long game here, where you're trying, you know, the Knicks have identified Mitchell Robinson, and part of it was also the capacity. They had full bird rights on him. They did not have that on Hartenstein. They had the limitations. We didn't know how the Knicks were going to structure their transactions, but they didn't have the capacity, but they also didn't need it to sign Hartenstein to his contract. Is that you're not only evaluating all of these players, RJ and whatever the young guys like Quentin Grimes are still around if they make a Mitchell trade, or if they don't make a Mitchell trade, you know, Grimes and everything, not only about how they fit right now, but we brought up the lens of 2024 of how these players fit with that iteration when this roster, you know, certain components of it could look really different. And so I think that for Leon Rose, for the rest of the front office, it is important to remember as they're watching the team this year that their best years are to come, but they're coming pretty soon. And so evaluating which of these bigs, evaluating how the smaller guys fit together in the context of what other moves do we need to make, what guys do we need to send out, what archetypes do we need to bring in to make this the best iteration it can be.
Yeah, I think that's very fair. I mean, the Mitchell Robinson contract was really interesting to me. I still don't quite know what to make of it because I am predisposed to not wanting to pay that much to an offensively limited center. I just think that the opportunity cost is not necessarily worth it. You know, you can get 80% of a Mitchell Robinson for 30% of the price. You know, they just signed Jericho Sims, for example, to a contract that's like less than $6 million over 3 years. And, you know, like only half of it is guaranteed over those 3 years. And Jericho Sims is not as good of a player as Mitchell Robinson. He's not as big of a body as Mitchell Robinson, but he does similar stuff. And I think you can make an argument that after what he showed last year and the end of last year, that he's pretty close, and his ability is much closer to Mitchell Robinson's, and his production is much closer to Mitchell Robinson's than his salary is. And I'm just predisposed to not necessarily wanting to give that much money to a guy who can be that, like a finishing center who doesn't shoot and doesn't do anything with the ball. It's just a lot of people tend to regret those contracts. We see them go out all the time, but even like Mason Plumlee, who's able to do stuff with the ball, is a really good passer. Like, he still signs for the mid-level exception or close to the mid-level exception, whatever it was, and then a year later ends up getting dumped to Charlotte and Detroit has to attach a second round pick to make it happen. You know, like, you know, you give Nerlens Noel close to the mid-level exception, and then you end up having to dump him to Detroit. It's just like, this is what happens when you pay those guys, and Mitchell Robinson got more than that. So I'm curious. But that being said, like you said, it's a descending contract. The cap is going to be going up. It's going to look a little better each year as his salary declines and the cap increases. So, and most importantly, they drafted him in the second round. You always want to string along the asset. You don't just want to lose something for nothing. And at the point of free agency, it's like they're going to lose him for nothing. He's pretty difficult to sign in trade because he's a base year compensation guy. So it's just, I don't quite know. I'm like conflicted in trying to, how do you evaluate that deal?
I like a lot that they front loaded it, because what that means is that the primary pain that you're taking is in a year that pain doesn't really matter, because the Knicks are far enough below the tax, all that type of stuff. They didn't have the flexibility to do it. So then one way to think about this is, yeah, Mitchell Robinson, you could argue he's overpaid this year. 3 years, $43 million after this year. That's imminently reasonable for a potentially starting, like, that's
what Daniel Gafford got,
yeah,
in his extension.
That's the salary for a guy who starts and doesn't finish like that. And yes, you could get somebody like Jericho Sims, but I think that Mitchell Robinson is meaningfully better there. I also simultaneously don't know where this kind of offer was coming from. And we see this every year in free agency. Another example like that at the same position was Nurkic, where Nurkic, that was probably maybe like this pre-negotiated, and like there just wasn't really another, there wasn't another suitor. There are teams with cap space, but were the Spurs and Pacers falling over themselves to sign another center? Maybe Troy Weaver would have done it in Detroit, but I sincerely doubt it. I mean, we saw how hard DeAndre Ayton had to work to get his offer sheet. And so my thought on it is, it was an overpay, but the way they structured it makes that overpay less consequential. And so, especially with the cap potentially going up, it's fine. It's, you know, it's a little bit over what you need to do, but it's not that big a deal. And in sometimes I would worry about the, you know, giving him 4 guaranteed years and, you know, the passage, but because it descends, those won't be as heavy, and there is a downside risk, but also Mitchell Robinson's pretty young. The curiosity that I have with it, and this connects Robinson and Hartenstein, is, so I'll connect back to something that also is Knicks related in 2021. In 2021, DeRozan was the exception, but then you had this group of shooting guards that all were seen as relatively similar. I didn't necessarily feel that way, but a lot of people did. And they all ended up with very similar contracts. About $18 million a year for Powell, Evan Fournier, Tim Hardaway Jr., and then Gary Trent got a little bit less, but he also got a shorter deal, something that Masai has done a couple times now. And so you had a grouping of those players who were thought of largely similarly. They were different ages and everything else, but they were kind of, you know, similar track as the, like, starter, but not a star type of player. And then, but then they all got not the same number of years, but relatively similar contracts. But then Nurkic, Hartenstein, and Robinson, and if you wanted to throw Kevon Looney in there or whatever centers people like in this mix, they didn't get similar contracts at all. Like, you know, like, Nurkic and Robinson got a lot of money, Hartenstein and Looney didn't, and part of that might be this is the bird rights trap, as our colleague John Hollinger puts it, is that two of those guys had that, and then Looney did, but they had the situation with the Warriors where that money gets just so prohibitively expensive, Looney appears to have been cool with it. And so there is a curiosity there of, did the teams that paid the premium get a premium for it? And we'll have to see.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, you look at the guys who have gotten, you know, those athletic finishing centers to various degrees. You know, the Wendell Carter Jr.'s got Carter, Wendell Carter got 4 for $50, and Robert Williams, who's, you know, at a much higher level, thought of as a much higher level than these guys right now. But at the time he signed his deal, you know, there are injury questions, and he was yet to have his career year, got 4 for $48 plus some incentives that'll take him over 50, I think to 54 if he gets some. You know, Gafford, I mentioned, got 3 for $40 in an extension. So Robinson's a little bit above that, but not in a gigantic way. And you're right, with the declining contract, it's not as big of a deal. He's 3 for $43, you know, after that. And then the last 2 years will look a lot different in a different cap environment. I was surprised, though. I thought there would be a team option on year four when we initially saw the numbers, because it would just be so Knicks to have a team option.
Yeah, they betrayed their own reputation.
It's true.
But
you know what? They created, they made up for it by, you know, normally the Knicks add a little something interesting in the contract. You know, we've gotten used to the team option, but they made up for no team option by making it declining. So it's fine. You're still a net even on Knicksiness with the contracts.
Yeah. I love the decline. I mean, people who listen to this podcast,
they did the same thing with Brunson.
Yep. They did it with Brunson too. And it could make it, in Brunson's case, if things go really well, it might make it harder to negotiate an extension, but I think they'll be okay. And you could always just re-sign him with bird rights or something else like that. So I told you beforehand there was going to be one less Knicksy thing that I was going to do, and it's a game that I play in my head and I've never actually played with you, which is, how can Russell Westbrook end up on the team Fred Katz is currently covering? And so I have a scenario, because I've been playing this game for 2 weeks. It's something I do every year. I want you to do it off the cuff. How does Russell Westbrook end up on the team Fred Katz is currently covering?
All right. Well, to be clear, before we play this game, I don't think he will this time. I think if he does somehow end up on the team that I'm covering, he will only be there for a second until there's some sort of buyout that follows. I've played the where does Russell Westbrook end up game so much over the last like 72 hours, and I just struggle to find a trade in which he's not immediately bought out upon the trade happening. Like, and when he's bought out, like, I don't know where he goes. I can't.
And so that is my answer to this, is that the Knicks make the Donovan Mitchell trade. The Donovan Mitchell trade involves both Derrick Rose and Emmanuel Quickley. And Russell Westbrook gets traded. Maybe it's to the Nets. Maybe it's to a third team. He gets bought out and then becomes the backup point guard for the Knicks. that is the most realistic way it happens. I do not think it's going to happen. I think that for myriad reasons, Russell Westbrook would end up somewhere else if he even leaves the Lakers in the first place. But that is, to me, that is the most realistic scenario, in part because the Knicks, like, they're not a logical facilitator in a Russell Westbrook trade.
Yeah, I know Mark Stein wrote that, and to be clear, Mark Stein did not write that. He was very clear that this was the opposite of imminent, but he wrote that if a Donovan Mitchell trade happens, one possibility would be doing like a Randall and other stuff for Westbrook deal, and then I think the implication of his report, if I can read between the lines, was that the Knicks would then buy out Westbrook in that case, and so it would really just be a dump of Randall. I don't see that happening.
Oh, by the way, I would hate that for the Lakers so much, because I think Randall's fit with LeBron and Anthony Davis is abysmal.
I know. I mean, here's the thing. He and Anthony Davis were like kind of okay together in New Orleans when they were together in New Orleans.
And I think they like each other personally from what I recall from that team had generally had pretty positive.
But there's a reason that Julius Randle came off the bench for a large chunk of that season. Like, it makes no sense. I don't know why that would be the guy you would commit yourself to.
Okay, that leads me to a last question. I know that you are not Leon Rose.
Let me finish on this one.
Oh, sure. Sorry.
Do you think that Russell Westbrook would happily embrace being a backup point guard anywhere?
No. No. If Russell Westbrook happily embraced being a backup point guard, we wouldn't be in the situation we're in right now, because a lot of ways what the Lakers are asking of him, it's you know, the parallel with Alex Crusoe. It's do less when you're a part of the bigger picture, and then do more when you're not. And Russell Westbrook's like, I'm good. And he has the right to do so. However, there are consequences of doing so. And so, yeah, I think that that's where things are.
I think you're right. I think that's definitely the most likely scenario, but I would deem the most likely scenario extraordinarily unlikely.
Yeah.
But I do think the most likely scenario is they use Rose's salary, because if they're going to trade for Donovan Mitchell, the guy, it's almost certainly going to include either Evan Fournier or Derrick Rose, because Fournier makes $18 million and Rose makes $14.5 million, and they have to get up to a little bit over $24 million in order to match salaries with Mitchell. So you kind of have to include one of those guys, and then the rest is pretty easy, because you're going to include at least a couple of young guys in there, and that's just going to get you there. And so, yeah, if they go Rose and they trade quickly, and yeah, I mean, that is definitely the most likely way. I agree.
But, okay, I realized I have one last question likely. For you. Imagining Please. That Fred Katz is running the Knicks unilaterally, it is your fiefdom. How would you be approaching Julius Randle right now? Would you be trying to trade him? Would you consider him positive? Would you only trade him for positive value? If you were running the Knicks, how would you be approaching? How would you be approaching him?
I would be aggressively trying to trade him, but in a fashion that I assume nobody would actually want him. So I would be trying to trade him, but hoping that there was somebody out there who would give something back for him. I think Julius Randle is like, I think you can go get Julius Randle if you really want Julius Randle, for what it's worth. I don't think it would take that much. I just don't think there is a team that has really had any interest in being able to do that. I don't think people really value him after the season he had last year. You know, he's got a 4-year extension that kicks in the upcoming season, and it's going to be at least $106 million plus some extra incentives. And I think people just, they don't want that after the season he had last year, when he was so inefficient, his defense really fell off. And like I said, he's got a reputation, whether he is willing to adapt or not. The reputation is that he's going to be disruptive to your ecosystem, that if you add him, then he is going to have to be your primary guy. And he's shown that if he's your primary guy, there is a cap on your offense. Like, even the season that he makes all NBA and receives second team all NBA and receives MVP votes only 2 years ago, like, the Knicks were still 24th in points per possession that season. And that, I'm not saying like, oh, Randle dragged him down, but it's like, it's not like just having even the best version of Julius Randle is enough to prop up your offense, even out of the bottom seven in the league, you know? So I think people are worried about that. So ultimately I would be trying to trade him aggressively, but I would not be like attaching things to him, because I think that would be extremely counterproductive to my future. And so I think where I would end up landing was, in actuality, would be just trying to bring him back, trying to rehab his value. The good news is, if you bring him back, is that he becomes a little bit more tradable every single day that you keep him, because every single day that he's on your roster more, his contract gets 1 day shorter. So he becomes a little bit more tradable every single day. So I would bring him back. I would hope that he could just, people are very binary with Julius Randle. It's like, oh, he's never going to be as good as he was during his, he's never going to be as good as he was during his all NBA season. So I guess they're screwed. I guess no one's going to want him. It's like, no, like, Julius Randle was really good in New Orleans. He had a 60% true shooting his sole year in New Orleans. If he's that level of player, that contract is fine. You know, that contract does not mean you have to have an all NBA caliber season in order to justify it. He has like the 50th highest salary in the NBA next season. It doesn't demand like MVP level play. It just means you have to be like a good player and someone will take it. So if he just has a good season, then all of a sudden you can be like, hey, Julius Randle's back. Now last season was really the outlier. Now he's had two outlier seasons on either side of the spectrum. And he's really just kind of the player that we saw in New Orleans and at the end in the Lakers, which is like a good player who's going to put up numbers and be productive. And I think at that point, it's a lot easier to move on from him. But I also would be like, you got to find a way to play Obi Toppin. You can't draft Obi Toppin eighth, have him look like he's going to legitimately be like a good, helpful player, and then just never give him an opportunity for 3 years to just not know what level he's going to be because you created this weird situation where you won't play the guy you drafted eighth. Like, you have to find a way to play Obi Toppin, whether Julius Randle's there or not.
That's a very healthy perspective on it. And Rose is going to have to navigate a weird challenge here, which is the simultaneous truth that Julius Randle is better than he was last year, but also is a bad fit with this iteration of the Knicks unless he really, really buys in. And so the framing of it as Randle being polarizing is, I guess, the term that I might use here, is that you need to have the temperature of the front offices that are on the good side of polarizing here, that think that Randle could help them. And whether those, you know, let's say we're narrowing the universe to 10 front offices, let's call it. Do you think that an average season by what we expect from Julius Randle raises his stock in their eyes? And my answer is yes, I think that it would. And the other reason you brought up Obi Toppin, which is important, is that as I see it with this Knicks team, Toppin is one possibility, but they don't really have enough wings or alternate theories of power forward that if you just straight up, like, let's say the amnesty provision existed, I wouldn't use it on Randle, I would not, but that you could fill that rotation spot easily. Like, in that sort of a circumstance, I think you should trade the player more aggressively. If you think they're a bad fit, they're not going to be happy, and you have a replacement. Toppin could be that. I don't think it's necessarily true. And then you need to replace Toppin in the other part. So what that kind of ties together to me is if somebody makes you an irresponsible offer, of course, you take it. That's true of almost anybody on any team. If you don't get that sort of a thing, I think unless that deal also gives you another potential answer for that spot within your rotation, then you can wait and see if this year is better. Because it's probably going to be the same teams that are interested. And also, doing so in the offseason, that flexibility is mostly gone now for other teams. Like, the reason a lot of trades happen in the offseason, not in season, is that rosters are more set. There's the lack of salary flexibility, everything else. But I think that at this point, unless like the Spurs or the Pacers really like Julius Randle and wanted to take him in and send more like less significant stuff back, and I sincerely doubt that's going to happen. So yeah, I think unless that deal happens, you hold on to him and you hope that things work out. And remember, we're both skeptical of his fit. I don't think that is a death sentence. I think that there is a distinct possibility that it works out, that he sees, hey, I can be a good player in this. I'll enjoy my life a lot more, and it will happen. And then, and also, like, as you said, Randle's contract, it's significant. It's not the biggest in the league. It's not the equivalent of like the Rashard Lewis or Tobias Harris contracts, especially with where the cap is going. So you can, in time, if it doesn't work, go in a different direction.
For sure. I think even people in the league, I was talking to this about with like a team's cap guy recently. And I think even people in the league, even though they are completely educated on just the basics of how the salary cap is going up and contracts are getting more expensive and a max contract has not necessarily gone up in proportion to the cap, max contracts are still 25%, 30%, or 35%. And thus they're, you know, as detrimental, a 35% max is as detrimental today as it was 5 years ago. But like I was talking with him, there's just something about a $100 million contract that makes people say, oh, $100 million for that guy. And Julius Randle being at $106 million, it just like it's the 50th highest contract in the league. It's significantly less than what his max contract would be. But when you see $100 million for someone, I think there are even people in the league who just like it's just hard. It's kind of like what we were talking about at the beginning. There's just a human element to all of this, and the human sees that extra zero. And I think it is hard for people to overcome being like $100 million for that guy. And there are people in the league who think about it, and there are definitely owners who think like this, who say, yeah, okay, it's gone up in terms of a percentage of the cap, but like it's the same amount of money out of my pocket. Like the world is not in proportion to the salary cap. Like me paying $100 million to Julius Randle today is the same as paying $100 million to Julius Randle 5 years ago for me. It's the same amount of money out of my bank account. So like I do think that extra little, human flaw and our bias towards round numbers, which is a concept I've grown very familiar with covering Russell Westbrook, plays into this too. And that's just like, you know, I don't think it would really affect things in the long term, but like it's like a thing people have to get over when they talk about Julius Randle. You know, it's like you can't just like ignore it. You kind of have to talk about it, get over it, and then move on to the next piece.
You brought that up. One other thing I'll say on that, people aren't ready for, we're not that far away from 25 million being starting solid starter money in the NBA. It's probably 2 to 3 years away. Like it's been 15 million, it's gone up to 18, maybe 20. And that's where this is, like, by the time Randle, like the last couple years of this contract, it's going to be solid starter money. And everybody's going to be just dumbfounded.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, it is dumbfounding.
Sure.
It's a lot of money.
It is.
It's just an extraordinary amount of money. So it is dumbfounding. Seeing anybody make that much money is like unbelievable. But, you know, as many say, would you rather the players who have worked their asses off in basketball all their lives get that, or would you rather it just be redirected to the billionaire owners?
Right. And it's amazing how often fans take ownership's perspective on this, and there will be an adjustment that has to happen for front offices, for ownership, for media members, for fans and players alike, that as it seems like we're shifting into another new financial paradigm in the NBA. It's a very good thing for a lot of different people involved, but it will be an adjustment to be sure.
Yeah. I've always wondered how, like, it'll never happen now because it's been established how we talk about salaries conversationally, and people are just kind of, people don't like percentages and ratios and all that crap. But I've just wondered if, like, from the very, very beginning of fans and media talking about NBA salaries in comparison to the salary cap, if we just, from the very beginning, when we were establishing how we were going to have this conversation, like way before you and I were ever in the media, if we just started right off the bat by not even talking about how many dollars players made, and we just said, oh, that's an 18% of the salary cap contract. Oh, he makes 19% of the salary cap in year one, 20% in year two, 21% in year three. Like it wouldn't be nearly as jarring. I think we would actually be much better as a society in evaluating the quality of these contracts, because it would eliminate that effect that I said before of like seeing the extra zero and being like, oh, $100 million for that guy. But that's never going to happen. It's not how people think. But I wonder if we had just trained, like if everyone just started doing that from the beginning when the salary cap first started, like I wonder if conversations like this would still be happening, or if like it just would have never taken, because ultimately people don't care about percentages and ratios and they want to talk about things in terms they're more familiar with.
It would definitely help the conversation. And I've thought a couple times about putting it in my own like salary sheets and stuff, just as a proxy kind of for myself, and having maybe you have some historical examples of, oh, you know, Victor Oladipo's contract in this year was that, or something else like that. It's a very good idea. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on.
Thank you for having me, man. I'm always happy to come on.
Thanks again to Fred Katz for taking the time to come on. You can read his excellent work at The Athletic, where he is the beat writer for the New York Knicks. Also, he is often on the Tampering Podcast, which is on The Athletic NBA show podcast feed. And if you don't already, you can follow him on Twitter at Fred Katz, FredKatz. Love having him on. And Fred's affinity for, you know, the nuances of the collective bargaining agreement is something that's part of, I think, how we've become friends and gotten along really well, is because he likes it. I know, I mean, we text each other fairly frequently. He's like trying to figure out how all this stuff works. And now he has it down pretty damn pat. So I really do appreciate that. If you want to support the show, there are a lot of different ways you can do it. You can subscribe, download every episode, really whatever podcast player you use, Apple, Spotify, wherever, because it's going to be on random days. It's my availability, guest availability, whether it's in season or out of season. It just depends on how these things work out. And in those same places, you can leave a rating and a review to help other people find the show, but you can also spread it through word of mouth, social media, wherever. Hey, this episode, whatever else, really do appreciate that. It helps other people find the show. Then the single most important thing you can do for this show and any other that has them is to check out our sponsors. We have the new sponsor of Athletic Greens. I'm really excited to have them on board and to have tried their product. athleticgreens.com/realgm, R-E-A-L-G-M. Also, it should be in the show notes. And betonline.ag, use that CLNS50 promo code to tell them that you came from us, and to get yourself, more importantly for you, a 50% welcome bonus. Can also check out my other work. Nate Duncan and I are back in business doing Dunked On and Dunked On Amazon Prime after he had a little time in the health and safety protocols. We will be starting our summer league breakdowns soon. Next couple days is the preliminary that we'll have the kind of the prep work done to start that. Really enjoy it. And then, of course, we've done a lot of other stuff. We revisited our top 10 players. First time we've ever done that after the playoffs. That was done recently. Written work is going to be coming soon at The Athletic. I have two pieces that I'm writing right now. I don't know when either is going to be ready for editorial. My instinct is next week, just depending on how quickly I can get these things turned around. And if you have any feedback on the show, good, bad, or indifferent, DannyLarueNBA@gmail.com is the way to get it to me. If you take the time to write it, I will take the time to read it. That is an absolute promise. I do it that day. I'm not always the greatest at replying, but that's why I call it feedback. So you could check that out. And thank you so much for listening. Take care and make it a great day.